Being the last speaker on a day-long program is never an enviable position, especially when the phone starts ringing. also, especially when your husband was on the helped plan the program, and you know everyone's thinking they desperately needed someone to fill in the last spot on the program. I thought maybe the best way to keep your attention would be to make sure that I didn't say what you expect me to say. Instead, I'd like to give you about a 2-minute summary of the remarks I think you're anticipating, and then draw them into a larger context. The role of the businessman in philanthropy is just the tip of the iceberg in what I think is becoming a much larger question, and that's the nature of the relationship between business and philanthropy generally. The number one cardinal rule of the businessman who engages in philanthropy should be to do no harm. If most businessmen turned philanthropists followed this dictum, philanthropy would be in a much better state than it is today. I would think everyone in this room, and especially those of you who have tried to raise money for conservative causes, understands all too well the syndrome of the businessman who, having succeeded in the commercial sector, is motivated by guilt or perhaps even some less negative feeling of noblesse oblige to give something back. In its most benign form, this sentiment translates into support for symphonies and museums, alma maters and churches, girls and boys clubs, and United Ways. In a more insidious form, it can result in philanthropic dollars being directed to causes that seek to bring about a radical restructuring of the social and economic system, thereby undermining the free institutions that make our prosperity and hence philanthropy possible. In many cases, bad philanthropy is promulgated by businessmen out of sheer ignorance, inattention, or an unwillingness to treat their philanthropy with the same degree of seriousness they devote to their business pursuits. Hence the examples of the Ford, Rockefeller, and MacArthur, and other foundations, whose founders, all very savvy businessmen, never put the pieces in place for their philanthropies to become effective supporters of the free market system. I would argue that America would be a better place today if these gentlemen had never found a need to give something back through their philanthropy. Better that their money were put back into their profit-making machines, where they would have produced more goods, services, jobs, and wealth, instead of into foundations that have only depleted our country's moral and financial capital. Fortunately, some of those who came later learned from the mistakes of their predecessors. These businessmen realized that their philanthropy could help shore up, rather than tear down, the political, economic, and cultural institutions that made their wealth possible and that offer the same opportunities to others. This conference has been devoted to discussing the ideas of one such gentleman, Pierre Goodrich, and I wouldn't be here representing the Philanthropy Roundtable if not for the right-thinking philanthropy of businessmen like John Olin, Jerry Milbank, Dick Scaife, H.B. Earhart, and Lyndon Harry Bradley. So much for my 2-minute analysis of the role of the businessman in philanthropy. All I have described so far is a phenomenon that most of us already know and understand, and which many of us are already trying to correct. What I think is actually a much more perplexing phenomenon is the changing nature of the relationship between philanthropy and business, a relationship that's been profoundly affected by government's intervention into both realms. Though government funding for nonprofit organizations has long been a concern to those who oppose the growth of government, only recently has the issue surfaced as part of mainstream discussion and debate. And it turns out that the so-called independent sector is not so independent after all, not when you consider that between a quarter and a third of its support comes from government sources. These figures, I believe, actually omit support for medical and educational institutions, which, when added in, make these figures much higher. Some social service agencies actually receive all or most of their funding from government. The National Council of Senior Citizens, for example, gets over 90% of its resources from government. CARE, a well-known organization, gets 78% of its funding from government. Save the Children relies on government for over 60% of its budget. The United Cerebral Palsy Association counts on it for over 80%. And Catholic Relief Services claims 72% in government support. The inappropriately named Volunteers of America derives fully 96% of its $51 million budget from government sources. Government spending on social services now exceeds military spending by $5 billion. New York's social service economy employs more people than Wall Street. Private social service agencies actually represent the New York City government's largest group of vendors. What might be called the government nonprofit complex does more than just consume taxpayer money. It uses that money to lobby for government programs that would take even more taxpayer dollars. Herein lies the impetus behind the Istook-McIntosh Amendment, which has performed such a tremendous service in drawing widespread attention to this phenomenon. We now know that the AARP, which is in no small part responsible for our soon-to-be bankrupt Social Security system, received $73.7 million in government funds last year. We've learned that the Environmental Defense Fund, a vocal advocate of stringent business regulation, got $500,000 in government support. The National Council of Senior Citizens, $77 million in debt to taxpayers last year, spent a good portion of its time lobbying Congress on behalf of President Clinton's health care reforms. The lists go on and on. Where businesses are concerned, the irony is compounded further. Not only are businessmen required to pay taxes that are used to support groups whose activities undermine the free market system, they must also deal with tax-funded groups that turn around and compete with them. Thus, in Pennsylvania, there's a marina operated by a nonprofit hospital that receives government funds. In New York, government funded housing competes with private development, and homeless shelters crowd out single room occupancy residences. In our nation's capital, George Washington University, a nonprofit institution that gets its share of government dollars, operates a hotel and restaurant. Nonprofits that compete with businesses in the provision of goods and services derive additional benefits from their tax exemption. In 1993, by way of example, the nonprofit Children's Television Workshop received $22.5 million in tax-free royalties from the sale of Sesame Street products. Now, a Sesame Street store just opened in a mall here on the north side of Indianapolis. I'm afraid I patronize it all too frequently with my son. But when I do, I can't help but wonder what the owners of the toy shop just a few doors down think when they lose business to a store that generates tax-free revenues for a nonprofit media outlet that gets government subsidies to produce shows that mock capitalism. The same might be said of the merchandiser who loses a sale to the Smithsonian catalog, which generates income to boost taxpayer-funded exhibits on the various racist, homophobic, militaristic, whatever other politically incorrect evils America has supposedly perpetrated. The independent sector's natural affinities should lie with the business sector. After all, its vitality depends on the wealth business produces. But as more and more support for nonprofits gets channeled through government, the independent sector's allegiances have shifted to the political domain. It's not just that these institutions think their well-being, and hence, of course, society's, depends on a generous government. It's also that they view for-profit ventures as second-rate, morally inferior, and perhaps even evil. So although, in theory, charities offer an alternative to government provision of social welfare, in reality, they have become so dependent upon and aligned with government that they no longer represent the kinds of institutions and associations we identify with Tocqueville's characterization of America. If, when we place our faith in the independent sector, we place our faith in these institutions, we're in for a big disappointment. Before we can rely on charities to help us dismantle government, we've got to get them off the dole themselves. Conservatives, who are very rightly concerned about the disintegration of civil society, also very rightly view private charities as one of America's best hopes of restoring the values that make a free and decent society possible. Amidst the carnage of failed federal programs and bureaucratized social service agencies that are inefficient at best and often positively destructive, conservatives are looking for alternatives. They're drawn to the small, innovative, and values-driven grassroots groups, those that are genuinely helping people in hopes that they can make the critical difference. Well, I agree that these grassroots efforts need all the encouragement they can get. I'm concerned that some of the initiatives conservatives are proposing would only undermine the very qualities that make them so successful. What I'm worried about are such initiatives as the high-level commission that was appointed by Newt Gingrich to examine how we can promote charitable efforts that are succeeding where government has failed. Among the recommendations the commission made was to find ways of channeling government grants and contracts to private charities so that they, rather than government, can become the first provider of social assistance. I contend that the worst thing you can do to a small, dynamic organization, and especially any organization that succeeds because of its faith-based orientation, is to establish a pipeline to it from the federal treasury. Government support will come with strings attached, strings that may prohibit these groups from engaging in the very activities that make them effective. It will come with paperwork and regulations. It will change charities' incentives, giving them reasons to keep caseloads up instead of getting them down. It will distort their missions. It will turn lean, cost-effective organizations into bloated bureaucracies. It will undermine what makes these organizations successful, and will at the same time create another constituency with a vested interest in government funding. Such concerns, unfortunately, are not merely hypothetical. Evidence of their legitimacy already exists. Once the Salvation Army decided to accept government funds, for example, which now amount to about 15% of its revenues, it had to stop requiring attendance at church services in return for the assistance it provides. Teen Challenge, a highly successful faith-based drug treatment center in San Antonio, has had to turn to the Institute for Justice for legal representation in a battle against the state to keep its doors open. The group's transgression, that it does not use state-licensed substance abuse counselors. In New York City, which as far back as the early 80s started contracting with local community-based organizations to deliver social services, the results have been positively disastrous. Numerous nonprofits that once derived just a small portion of their income from government now get almost all of it from government grants and contracts. The proliferation of social service agencies has destroyed neighborhoods, pushed out legitimate businesses, thwarted private development, and created a cadre of activists who now occupy controlling blocks on city councils and in government agencies. There's another problematic initiative called the Project for American Renewal, which is being pushed by Senator Dan Coats. This consists of 18 legislative bills and is motivated by the view that if we're going to dismantle government, we must offer something positive in its place. The legislation directs roughly 7% of federal welfare spending to private anti-poverty charities. It offers a $500 tax credit for donations to charities doing poverty work, implements waiting periods and counseling for couples intending to divorce, gives grants to school districts to establish single-sex schools, and provides for $50 million in vouchers that pregnant women could use at private or religious group homes. Its intention is a very noble one, which is to carve out a more central role for institutions that are neither market-based nor government-run. But in my view, it's actually more likely to destroy the voluntary market that exists for private charity by insinuating government into the decision-making process. If our vision of civil society is one that requires government micromanagement, I think the independence and innovation of the charitable sector will only be weakened by our pursuit of it. Other proposals are circulating that would allow taxpayers to divert a percentage of their taxes to private charities. These are similarly motivated by the desire to get government out of the provision of social welfare. Here again, though, I fear government's gain may come at the expense of the charitable sector's effectiveness. First, there's a question of who decides what charities are eligible to receive these taxpayer-directed contributions. Does Hillary get to decide? Or does any organization now determined by the IRS to be a charity qualify, in which case taxpayer contributions could be directed to Ralph Nader's outfits, to the Children's Defense Fund, National Public Radio, Greenpeace, the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and so on? One could hardly view such a reform as a step in the direction of a freer society. In fact, all sorts of institutions that sound charitable, like Catholic Charities of America, the Child Welfare League of America, and the American Cancer Society, are really not much more than advocacy groups that do much more to expand government's responsibilities than to actually help people. I think it's also probable that a huge diversion of tax monies to charitable institutions would create a false market for their services, thereby creating bureaucracies where charities once existed. If government is spending too much on social welfare programs, the situation won't be solved by merely by giving taxpayers a say in how to spend that money. Nor will the situation be improved if citizens are lulled into thinking that a diversion of their tax obligation to nonprofit institutions represents real charity. Charity undertaken with money that's collected by force isn't what I call charity. This brings me to the policy reform that I think could have the most profound impact on the charitable sector, and that's the flat income tax. Here, in their desire to soften the impact of the flat tax and shore up charities' role in reinvigorating civil society, many on the right are arguing that any flat tax that might be adopted should retain the deduction for charitable gifts and contributions. My fundamental concern about this recommendation is that it creates a preference for accomplishing things through the charitable sector as opposed to the marketplace. Ideally, the charitable deduction would make it possible for the charitable sector to handle the needs that fall through the cracks of the marketplace. But economic activity that is driven by the charitable deduction ends up creating incentives for charities to perform tasks that were once handled by business. If you would prefer that people eat in diners rather than soup kitchens, that they live in privately developed housing rather than Habitats for Humanity, and if you think a job created by an entrepreneur is better than one generated through a worker retraining program, then you should be against giving special preference to the charitable way of doing things versus the commercial way. When the charitable deduction was first introduced, the marketplace was the primary institution, and charitable efforts were viewed, in a sense, as the icing on the cake. I think we've gotten to a point where those priorities have become almost reversed. It's become far too common, even among conservatives, to look to the nonprofit sector first, especially when we think about providing for those in need. But the best thing for those in need is a strong economy. It's not another welfare program, even if that welfare program is a private one. This is not to say that I'm not in favor of lower taxes wherever we can get them, or that I'm against soup kitchens, or Habitat for Humanity, or even worker retraining programs. To the contrary, I think these offer a wonderful, non-governmental way of helping people who don't quite make it in the marketplace. It's just that I'm hesitant to turn to the charitable sector when the commercial sector is able and willing to do the job. And that I'm against thinking a task is more noble simply because it's charitably performed. I'm for putting the charitable sector back in its proper place, which is not prior to business, but in a respectful position of secondary importance. The charitable sector is, after all, dependent upon the fruits of the for-profit sector for its very existence. Its endeavors are successful precisely when they bring about the kind of self-improvement that makes productive participation in the wealth-producing arena possible. It's likely the truly flat tax would bring about a radical alignment of the relationship between business and charity, and I don't think this would be a bad thing. In fact, a flat tax would probably alter rather dramatically the nature of the charitable sector as we now know it. Would giving go down without the charitable deduction? Most likely not. Historically, giving has always increased when taxes have been cut. Though the tax advantages of charitable contributions are reduced when rates go down, the rise in disposable income that results more than offsets any negative impact. The elimination of the capital gains tax, another reform the flat tax calls for, would reduce the incentives for large gifts of appreciated securities, which would probably mean fewer endowed foundations created out of gifts of stock and fewer gifts of appreciated securities to community foundations and other public charities. But again, it would generate more disposable income for stockholders to give away as they see fit. The elimination of the capital gains tax would also reduce some of the advantages that nonprofits now have over for-profits. The nonprofit hospital that currently earns tax-free income on its investments would lose that competitive edge it has over a for-profit hospital. An obvious question, I think, is why, just because it's managed as a nonprofit as opposed to a for-profit, one hospital should have that edge over another. Studies actually indicate that for-profit hospitals provide more free medical care to indigents than nonprofit hospitals do. So just because a hospital is nonprofit does not mean it is necessarily contributing more to society than the free for-profit and therefore more deserving of tax-exempt status. It's only one step removed to ask why Eli Lilly and Company should pay all sorts of taxes when the Lilly Endowment does not. Has the Lilly Endowment, even with all its good works, really done more good for society than the Eli Company with its pioneering development of life-saving drugs and medical devices? The flat tax would create a more level playing field between for-profits and nonprofits, not by taxing nonprofits more, but by burdening for-profits less. Except where local property and sales taxes are concerned, the tax exemption would basically become meaningless to many nonprofits. Institutions like the NFL and the PGA, hardly what we think of when we think of charity, would lose the substantive advantages they enjoy because of their tax-exempt status. Let them remain nonprofit. There's no reason they shouldn't be. But there's no reason they should get a tax exemption just because of it. This last comment, I think, broaches the question of what would distinguish a nonprofit from a for-profit if the tax exemption for nonprofits were eliminated. I think it's a fascinating question. I'm not going to go into it here, but I haven't heard anyone talking about it, and I hope some will begin to turn their attention to it. The elimination of the inheritance tax, the final feature that I want to address about the flat tax proposals that are being circulated, brings us full circle to the subject at hand. My guess is that the elimination of estate taxes would dramatically reduce the rate of foundation formation. But if that reduced the number of foundations that are created by people just to get the tax deduction, chances are we'd have a lot fewer foundations run by guilt-ridden heirs bent on distributing the rest of society's wealth. Better that that money be given away by donors in their lifetimes, or even that it be passed on to heirs to buy yachts or invest in the stock market, either of which would at least make a productive contribution to the economy. The truth is that very few men or women have been as thoughtful in their philanthropy as Pierre Goodrich. He understood that the best the independent sector can do is defend and promote the free society so that others may prosper as he did. It's his view of charity as secondary to and supportive of the free market that ultimately makes it superior. Thanks.